Luke 15, verse 1, we get a picture of the setting of this parable of what we've many times called the prodigal son. And he says, "Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear him." Tax collectors in the ancient world were people who were collaborators with the occupation culture, the Roman pagan folks. They were collaborating with the pagans who were notorious in their licentiousness, notorious in their greed, right? They're collaborating with them in order to get the big bucks, in order to get good standing with the regime, okay? And so tax collectors and other various sorts of sinners were gathering around and were attracted and intrigued by Jesus. In other words, Jesus was not attracting all of the church-going folks. He wasn't. Look, the Pharisees, verse 2, "But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, they muttered, 'This man welcomes sinners and shame of all shame. He eats with them. He celebrates the kingdom meal with them.'" And so, never forget this. It was church people that didn't like Jesus. It was the tax collectors and the sinners that found him really intriguing. And we got both of them together at this point. You got the folks who think they're all right and they've got all the answers and they got the kingdom hammered out and they're fixing to restore it with their own religious program, and you got the people who were sold out and strung out and excluded and have the worst kind of reputations in the Jewish community, and they're all right there together. And the churchified people are murmuring. They're murmuring. And so Jesus tells them this story. Verse 11. "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the inheritance now. Give me my share of the estate.' And so he divided," the father did, "his property between the two sons," between them. "Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had and set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth on riotous living, wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in the whole country, and he began to be in need. And so he went and hired himself out to the citizen of that country, and who sent him to the fields to go feed pigs. You know that pigs are an unclean animal, and in Jewish thinking, that's about as low as you can go, right? And so he's out there slopping hogs. It's not like an Iowa pig farmer who might be quite wealthy and have a good reputation. This is the guy that's slopping hogs in a faraway country. And he longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating. But no one ever gave him anything. You ever slop hogs in the old days? It's not like, you know, they've got all the soybean supplements and they got it in a nice, fine, sweetened up meal that most people in parts of the world would love to eat themselves. No, this is This is every bit of the peeling and the nasty rind. It's really the garbage that they're feeding the hogs, and he is looking like, ooh, this garbage is gourmet. And when he came to his senses, amen, he said, "How many of my father's hired men have food to spare, and here I'm starving to death? I'll set out and go back to my father and say to him," now he's got his speech, he's rehearsing the speech already, right? "How in the world am I going to show my face back to my dad? Okay, here we go. Here's his speech he's preparing. "Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men." And so he got up and went to his father. Maybe he will take me back as a slave. Maybe I can start paying my way if I hire myself out as a slave in my dad's household. Okay, but while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. And he ran to his son. He threw his arms around him and he kissed him. And the son said to him, okay, he's got the speech ready, right? Here's the speech. "Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father said to his servants, quick! He interrupts the speech. Before he can get this stuff about being a servant or a slave in your household out, the father character interrupts the speech and listen to what he says. "Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him." Oh, put the best one on him. Joseph, we need a coat of, I don't know if the prodigal was named Joseph or not, but we're going to put that robe, that family robe, that special thing on him. Bring the best and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger. And you know what a ring is in the ancient world? It's a signet ring that you stamp business with. You know what Dad just gave him? He just gave him the family credit card. He just gave him the family credit card. And sandals, put the sandals, the readiness of the gospel of peace, as Paul would put it, on his feet. And bring the fatted calf and kill it. And let's have a feast to celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And so they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. And when he came near the house, he heard the music and the dancing. And so he called one of the servants and asked him, "What is going on?" "Your brother has come," he replied. "And your father has killed the fatted calf because he has come. He has him back safe and sound." And the older brother became angry and refused to go in. And so the father once again, you know, you catch it? The father once again goes out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you." I mean, the younger brother wanted to come back and be a slave. He says, "I've already been one. All these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you kill the fatted calf for him." "My son," the father said, "my son, you're always with me. And everything I have is yours. I gave it to you ahead of time. It all belongs to you now. But we just had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours, not just a son of mine, but this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. Dead and alive again. He was lost and he's found. At one level, of course, this story is rightly named the story of the prodigal son. The word prodigal means wasteful or recklessly extravagant. Everybody say recklessly extravagant.
Recklessly
extravagant. Prodigal doesn't mean sinful. It means recklessly extravagant. It means lavish. It makes no sense how much money he's spending, kind of stuff. Prodigal. And indeed, it is a prodigal son that leaves, a prodigal who wastes in reckless, lavish spending. And indeed, he, like most lottery winners, it just doesn't take him very long to go through his lottery winnings. There's a reason why you don't go out in uncontrollable sexual and party lifestyles. It diminishes life. License destabilizes. It destabilizes relationships. It destroys love and trust. It's like seeking life by pursuing death. That doesn't usually turn out very well. It's like trying to fix a debt crisis with more spending. Psalm 7 says, if you keep digging a hole, you're eventually going to fall into it. He who conceives trouble gives birth to disillusionment. And that's a losing, wasteful, prodigal proposition. You don't have to believe me, of course. Far be it from me to be preachy about not spending $100,000 on oceanfront property in Arizona. I could probably preach about that and try to tell you that it's not a good idea. But if you're bent on spending $100,000 on oceanfront property in Arizona, there's not much I can do to keep you from doing it. You really can't tell this prodigal, this young prodigal, anything. He resents what he considers preaching. He hates authority because he thinks there are greener pastures in Arizona. You haven't ever been to Arizona, have you, Dad? The pastures are greener there. And he resents what he considers all of this needless kind of restrictive lifestyle. And he says, I'm going to do my thing. It's interesting to me that the father in this story does not say one single word to the younger son. He just kisses him and does what he asks. Anyway, the younger son's wasteful and prodigal course will come to a dead end pretty soon, and if people will leave the person who's wasting their lives alone, pretty soon they'll take their talent and they'll take their charm and they'll take their inheritance and they'll take their opportunities and they'll drive them straight into the pig pen, the one pig pen that's left in the Arizona desert. So there's no need for preaching. Paul's words to Timothy ring true. The sins of some men are obvious. They reach the place of judgment ahead of them. Okay. So far, calling this parable the parable of the prodigal son works all right. But here's where Tim Keller And here's where I think the parable begins to be something far more profound. Tim Keller wants to tell us it's a story not of the prodigal son, but of the prodigal God. The father knows perfectly well what's going to happen to his life savings if he turns the inheritance over to the boys right now. The older brother is given 2/3 of the land. It seems that the younger brother got the cash or 1/3 of the farm that he turned into cash pretty soon after he got the inheritance. And so the spoiled younger son goes up to the father and he says, "Dad, I need you to drop dead, at least legally, because you're cramping my style. I want the property now, please. Your life is really an impediment to me. Your restrictions, your family life, it's all cramping me. What I want is to really express my own self. I want to go." Basically, he's saying, "I don't want you, Dad." And the father knows that a kid that comes and says, "I want my dad to be dead. I want the money now." That's not the kind of character you want to be the CEO of your business. But he gives the kid the money anyway. He is a prodigal father. Recklessly extravagant. He's like the parent who sends his kid off to college and he takes out a second mortgage to pay for the study, and the kid squanders the tuition and the room and the board on partying all night, doesn't study, and flunks out of school. Mm-hmm. And this dad does what? He takes out another mortgage and gives it to him. He gives the entire bank to the kids. There is the lavish and the reckless spending. The father figure, the God figure, is the chief prodigal in the story. And it's only going to get scandalously worse because the young kid's got his speech prepared, right? He gets out here in the pig pen and he's got his speech prepared and he comes back. And watch what happens. Look what happens. The next thing is that the father who's on the porch of the farm, which is no longer his porch, it's the older brother's porch. He's sitting out there and he runs. I mean, in the ancient world, dad doesn't do the running to the kids, and the kids do the running to the dad. But in this case, this dad runs after his son. I don't know. I mean, the kid's obviously lost a lot of weight. He's misshapen in a variety of ways, but God knows his child. The father knows his son's gait, and while he's still far off, he runs after him. And the boy starts in with his speech, and he states the obvious, "I've blown it against heaven and against you, Dad." But Dad interrupts him and orders the servants to bring in and all the things that we've talked about, and he throws a big blowout party. This is the story of a prodigal God who's not interested in what it costs him, but is interested in relationship with those he loves. N.T. Wright tells us that we need to hear this like Israelites would have heard it. This is not just the story of one prodigal son, it's the story of Israel. It's the story of Israel thrown out into exile because of their willfulness, because of their sin, because of their prodigal, lavish lifestyle, right? They end up in a faraway land enslaved to some other people. But here he comes back. It's the restoration of Israel. He's coming back, and the restoration of Israel is about to take place in the work of Jesus of Nazareth. And what do we have impeding the progress? The people who are in charge of the farm. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the teachers of the law, the leaders of the churches. Huh? They've got charge of the farm. And that's the reason I think all the preaching and the pleading and the story is done to the older son. And so this story is not just about a prodigal God. It's a story about prodigal sons. Prodigal sons. I love this picture. Look like any church you've been in. The party's in full swing by now. Right? The party's in full swing. And let's watch the story unfold again. Let's watch it. Stage right enters Mr. Responsibility. Stage right enter Mr. Whining, Mr. Elder Brother. He comes up and he doesn't like the sound of the music. It's too loud. It's too raucous. He probably sees the waiters scurrying around with roast veal platters and everything else, and he asks one of the servants, "What's this all about? I didn't commission a party. Do you know how much this is costing?" And the servant says, "No, no, your brother has come home, and your father's killed the fatted calf because he's received him safe and sound." And the older brother is angry, and he won't join the party. There's a great big kingdom party, Jesus is saying. Huh? I'm throwing this great big party. And the tax collectors and the sinners, they're cotton on to it. Israel's being restored. The long lost exile from the far country is over. In my work, Israel's being restored. And you're invited. But he won't go in. Won't go in. He's right there in the midst of the party. He's invited to the party. But he won't go in. And so notice the parallel. God, the Father God figure, goes out again to his other lost son. He says, "Look. Look, Dad. All these years I've been slaving for you. And you never once threw me a party." And Dad says, "Well, I gave you everything. I mean, for goodness sake, you got the money. If you wanted to throw a party, you could have made 52 different stalls for each oxen and kind of fatted them up on the way and had a party like this every week, and I would have loved it. But you didn't have that, Mr. Whining, Mr. Responsibility. You know why you didn't have that? Because you're a bean counter. You're a bean counter. You don't care anything about me. My son has come home. But that doesn't make any difference to you. You're too busy counting your inheritance. Your brother has come home. He was dead and he's alive again. But that doesn't make any difference to you because you're not about relationship. You're about keeping the rules and counting the money. And keeping the family's respectability up in the neighborhood." Huh? We live in a bipolar society today in the United States. A bipolar society that mirrors in amazing number of ways the society in ancient Israel. Indianapolis is full of younger brothers that have left the farm and have come to the big city, and they're sowing their wild oats and they're going to pursue a life of self-discovery. And Indianapolis is full, and the churches are also full of people, though they think they're well-meaning, who are really at their core older brothers who would rather keep their churches nice and tidy according to their rules, according to what they think is respectable, and who are pursuing a path of what I might call, and what Tim Keller calls, moral conformity. There's no real living relationship with a prodigal God. There's no real relationship between the people in the community. They're really just about doing the moral thing because the moral thing makes you more money and makes life easier in the end. Yes? Both sets of people are pursuing that same kind of agenda, and the relationship with the God of Israel is not there. Think of it in Speedway. We live in this city where the younger brother types have left home and they come to the big city and they enter the race in a car number one called self-discovery. But after a couple of laps in the 500-mile raceway, they think, this is really kind of boring. Every time you have to turn left. Turn one, turn left. Turn two, turn left. Turn three, turn left. Turn four, turn left. I get tired of turning left. I'm going into the pits and I'm going to turn right. And they do. They turn right. They go under the stands. They come back up. And then they turn left on 16th Street. And they say, this looks like fun. And off they go 180 miles an hour right down 16th Street. Huh? And you know what's going to happen. They're going to crash headlong into Long's Donuts. Why should I turn left every time just because Tom Carnegie, once upon a time, that old thing, said that you should? Churches, however, tend to be filled with the older brother types who fill out the other pole of our bipolar society. They have qualified their car, number 77, called moral conformity. And the moral conformists complain about the younger brothers, the immoral people. And the younger brothers complain about the bigoted people who they say think they have all the truth. And the moral conformists say, yes, we do. And they keep the car between the lines. They will not go faster than the 30-mile-an-hour speed limit, even in the Indianapolis 500. They're keeping the speed limit. They keep it between the lines. And they go 30 miles an hour, and they think they're doing a great job in the race car race. They don't even realize that they're not on the track, that they're running through the nice golf country club out there, the brickyard, and they're just doing the cart path out there at 30 miles an hour all around, and they think everything is hunky-dory because they are keeping it between the lines, man. Look how good we are. Both are on the wrong track. Do you agree with me that both race cars are on the wrong track? The self-discovery people are sick of that and they're trying to have a good time. They're sick of the track, huh? The trouble is when that driver one crashes into Long's Donuts at 180 miles an hour, he's going to know that not everything is okay. He can't pretend that everything is okay. driver 77 or 70 times 7 perfect between the lines having a good time at the country club has a hard time figuring it out that he's not even on the right racetrack. He has a hard time figuring out that real life is more than showing off in a self-promotional parade. That life is more than just one endless series of responsibilities that keep on going and keep you from thinking. That life is more than just rushing and rushing and doing all the moral things for the moral reasons in order that you can have good standing. It's more. And you come to realize that really, this kid that is stayed home on the farm has squandered his life too. He's more of a slave than the younger ever was. He just doesn't know it. And the text says, I've been slaving for you. We live in a culture where the younger brother and the older brother are at each other's throats. We live in this bipolar culture. And one is pursuing happiness and pursuing life through self-discovery, and the other is pursuing success and happiness and fame or whatever through a kind of moral conformity. But both of them are missing something. And what they're missing is the lavish grace of God. Christianity arose in a society where Christianity wasn't really what people today think of when they think of a religion. Christianity in the first century was the non-religion religion. In fact, the Romans called them atheists. They called Christians atheists because they didn't have a temple. They didn't have priests. They didn't make sacrifices anymore. And as in this story, it was the religious people who were offended by Jesus' attentiveness to tax collectors and harlots and unrepentant, just messed up people. Huh? And the story says no matter how bad you have violated relationship, God is right there on the front porch ready to pursue you. Ready to come after you if you will come. He wants to take you back, and not only to take you back, he wants to throw a blowout party. He wants to throw a party like you didn't know was possible. He wants to throw the kind of party that is far more fun and far more uninhibited than any kind of drunken brawl you've been in before. God still goes out and he invites that person who has wasted his life. And he goes out and he invites that person, that son of his, who's wasted his life in the church pews, who's wasted his life in the very backyard farm of his father. He goes out and he pleads with a gracious lavishness that gives all that he's ever got his entire life. In fact, the word property that they divide, that the father divides, it's the word bios. Bios. Life. The father divides his life between the sons lavishly, recklessly, extravagantly, or as Paul said, scandalously, because that is the God who is at the base of all things. At the base of all things is Israel's God, and that Israel's God turns out to be so lavishingly loving that it blows everybody's categories. And our invitation today is to come to Jesus, to come to this God who is a prodigal God,
who will lavish His love upon you who've wasted everything. Whether it be in the church pews, doing the right thing for the wrong reasons, or doing all the wrong things for the right reasons. Huh? Did you hear that? Whether you've been doing all the right things for the wrong reasons or whether you've been doing all the wrong things for the right reasons, God's lavish grace is given to you today. He pleads with you. Come join the party. And that's your invitation as we stand and sing.